Yeah, you heard that right. A bank failure. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Friday today, the 10th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So what if there was a bank that maybe you had never heard of? And what if that bank was maybe a key piece of a big part of this economy? And what if that bank, kind of out of nowhere, failed? That would bring you to today, right now, in a bank called Silicon Valley Bank, which this morning became the first bank backed by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation to fail since 2020. The FDIC has taken it over, taken its assets, and is sorting through the mess. The question, of course, is, now what? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour gets us going.
Silicon Valley Bank is not a regular bank. A lot of its depositors are startups and investors.
It's just where all our money sits, revenue, investment, how I pay out the employees.
Nadine El-Ashkar is CEO of Lillo.
We're a marketplace for hotels to do all their procurement in one place.
Linens, uniforms, food, drink, all that stuff. El-Ashkar is on a group chat with other startup CEOs, and yesterday it blew up. Her CEO friends were starting to get warnings from their investors. Take your money out. She tried, but the site was down. So she sent a board member to move the money in person.
The security were not letting anyone in. And then eventually the police came and said, this is private property, and basically kicked everyone out.
Her company and many others cannot get to their money.
Like, I'm beating myself now, but how could I have known such an established bank could crumble in literally 24 hours?
Here is how Silicon Valley Bank got into trouble. First, its clients, all those startups and venture capitalists, weren't raising as much money this past year, and their bank accounts were getting smaller. Not a huge deal, but
there's a double whammy.
Eric Gordon is a professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
At the same time that the companies are withdrawing money from Silicon Valley Bank, its other big assets, which was very safe government bonds, have gone down in value.
The bonds lost value because the Fed has been raising interest rates. Interest rates go up, bond values go down. As more of SVB's clients took out their money, it had to sell bonds at a loss, and it wasn't enough. There are a lot of banks that own bonds that have lost value. Conrad Alt is a co-founder of Claros Group.
At year end last year, there were something like $620 billion in accumulated losses in the securities portfolios of the banking industry.
Alt calculates that's equivalent to about 28% of the capital in the banking industry as a whole.
That's obviously not good news for any bank, but it's not necessarily a crisis. The crisis occurs if you have to sell and take losses.
But banks since the financial crisis are much better capitalized and don't have niche, undiversified clients like SVB did. So the risk of some mass contagion is low. But Alt says there are probably some other banks out there that could run into trouble. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, the banking sector did terribly, that's for sure. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The week that was in this economy, and there was a lot, coming up in just a sec. It's not like the week in this economy needed a bank failure to make it interesting. We had Jobs. We had Jay Powell. Who could ask for anything more? Catherine Rampell's at the Washington Post. Gina Smilek's at the New York Times. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
So, Gina, I want to start with you and a tweet of yours that I saw this morning, and I apologize. I forget who you were quoting, but this person pointed out that what happened to SVB is a pretty excellent example of the long and variable lag that we talk about with monetary policy all the time. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah, so it was Aneta Markowska at Jefferies who said that. And I think it's a really interesting point, actually. She's basically saying here that, you know, we have had a lot of adjustment in interest rates over the past year, and it takes a while to see the full impact of that. So it's not like SVB, this bank that is failing. It's not like these problems just started appearing yesterday at this bank. You know, they've been in train for a while, but the things take a while to fully work through the system for it to come to fruition for us to see them. And so these stresses, the, you know, either stresses on the financial system or stresses in the economy, they can take a while to show up. And so the point she was making was, you know, I think there's this idea that because markets price what the Fed's going to do so quickly these days, that we all kind of think, you know, long and variable lags, that's, you know, a 1990s problem, but actually long and variable lags still exist.
1990s problems. Catherine, I don't want to make too much of this, but how heavily do you suppose this is weighing on Jay Powell's mind, because he's already got a lot on his plate?
It definitely doesn't make his job easier. Right. The primary job of the Fed is their dual mandate, maximum employment, stable prices. He's already getting, he and the other members of the Fed, I should say, have already been getting a lot of flack for the path of interest rate policy so far. Have they not been aggressive enough at dealing with inflation? Are they being too aggressive now? And are they going to, tip the economy into recession, throw people out of work, et cetera? There were already too many trade-offs for them to consider. And now add on top of that, this concern about stresses in the financial sector. And, you know, financial stability is also one of their key responsibilities. So if they're trying to get inflation down to some extent, that goal is in opposition to the things that they might be doing to make financial conditions, ease financial stresses in the banking sector, I should say. So, and it's not like there's a formula that they can turn to, unfortunately. So basically it just makes his life harder.
There is not a formula, Gina, but there is data. And Chair Powell talked this week a lot about the totality of the data. The jobs report today, obviously 311,000 new jobs last month. Interest, the unemployment rate ticks up a little bit. That's a data set. There's more coming next week with CPI, the inflation number, and retail sales. Here's a hypothetical for you. Jay Powell calls you up, because I'm sure they have your phone number somewhere at the New York Times, in the Fed, and says, Gina, what should I be looking at? What would you tell him?
You know, this is not a scenario that happens to me. It would be interesting if it did. You know, I think actually the thing that I would look at if I were the Fed that I don't think is sort of on the regular menu of everything they already look at is the earnings season calls, because they have been really interesting this time. You know, I think we've seen a lot of signs from some of the consumer facing companies that things aren't deteriorating maybe as quickly as we had previously thought, and that they still think they have some degree of pricing power, or they think that they can figure out how to keep some degree of pricing power. And I think that's a pretty interesting signal. So I think those earnings calls, that's what I would be looking at.
Catherine, same question to you, because, you know, he's got the phone number of the Washington Post, too.
Yeah, I'm sure he has me on speed dial. He just conveniently forgets to call. I think one thing that hasn't been as much in the news that maybe should be on the radar screen is what's happening with state level fiscal policy. There has been this puzzle about why demand has held up so much, given we've had 8 consecutive interest rate hikes. And it looks like at the federal level, fiscal policy has not been particularly stimulative. If anything, it's been dragging on the economy, because we had the stimulus checks and various other COVID emergency plans before, programs before. They're gone. If anything, that should be weighing on the economy. But almost every state in the country has cut taxes in the past year or so, and many more are cutting taxes now. That's giving consumers more money to play with, and that could potentially be pushing up consumer spending and demand and partially explain this puzzle that we have about why the economy has held up so well, why demand has held up so well. But there hasn't really been a comprehensive look at the magnitudes there. So that's one thing I'd be looking for.
I think we would all take a partial explanation right now in lieu of what we've got, which is, I don't know. Okay. So, Gina, I want to talk about Chair Powell's testimony this week. And I want to ask you about something it seemed like he kind of ad-libbed it, and it was this. He said on the first day in front of the Senate, he said, I want to look at the totality of the data before we figure out what we're going to do with interest rates. And then on the second day in front of the House, he said, I want to look at the totality of the data, and I want to stress that no decision has been made. Why do you think he's so emphatically saying we don't know yet?
Okay, so I actually think that this is because when he said the totality of the data line on day one, a bunch of Wall Street analysts, including ones who people, you know, widely respect, sent out notes saying 50s ago, you know, we're going half a point, we're going to do a jumbo-sized interest. Yeah, exactly. We're going to do a jumbo-sized interest rate increase in March. And previously, we'd all been expecting a quarter point increase in March. And so I think that the just shift that people just saw it, not only as putting a bigger move on the table, but is almost locking a bigger move in. It seems like that was probably a little bit too aggressive. It wasn't what they wanted. And so I think he was really trying to massage the situation and basically say, you know, it's possible that we're going to do this bigger rate move, but it's not 100% definite. Like, do not convince yourself that this is the only possibility at this stage. And so I think what he was really trying to do was buy them some wiggle room there.
Gina Smilek at the New York Times, Catherine M. Pell at the Washington Post. We are sadly out of time because we could talk about this stuff forever. Thanks, you two. Have a nice weekend.
Thanks, Scott. Thank
Bye. So the unemployment rate went up last month, not a whole lot, but up, and usually that's not great. But if you have taken anything from this program the last couple of years, there is nothing usual about this economy right now, because the labor force has been growing, more than 400,000 people in February, actually, which gets us to that thing that happens sometimes, where that which seems maybe bad, maybe isn't. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has this one.
A combination of factors can push the unemployment rate higher, says EY chief economist Greg Dacko.
It can be that employment actually declined, or it can be that more people are looking for employment.
What stands out in today's jobs report is how many Americans, 242,000, are in that second category. Elise Gould of the Economic Policy Institute says growth in the number of people looking for work means the unemployment rate is rising for the right reasons.
More of them did not find jobs and found jobs, but that sort of optimism, I think, is a positive move for the labor market.
But Gould says the trends are playing out differently across demographic groups. Take the group the government classifies as Hispanic or Latino men, says Kate Bond, chief economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. She says they make up more than half the growth in labor force participation, but aren't being employed at the same rate as other groups.
At least in the past few months, Hispanic men among all groups of workers have not been able to capture the gains of a tight labor market.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics says 37,000 Hispanic or Latino men lost jobs in the last month. Still, Gus Fauché, chief economist at PNC Financial Services Group, says overall this month's data points to a strong labor market.
People think this is a good time to be searching for a job.
He says policymakers at the Fed will be watching to see if that sentiment lasts. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we jumped at signing that lease.
When you find the right place, you find the right place. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawa's again. I think that's three times this week, right? Dow Industrial's down 345, 1%, 31,909. The NASDAQ retreated 199 points, 1.75%, 11,138. The S&P 500 reversed itself 56 points, 1.4%, 38.61. For the week, the Dow gave back 4.4%. The NASDAQ shed 4.7%. The S&P 500 fell 4.5%. So, Sabrina was telling us about the demise of Silicon Valley Bank. Under the aegis of the FDIC, it is now called Deposit Insurance National Bank of Santa Clara. SVB had about $209 billion in total assets and about $175 billion in deposits. Something else to know, the FDIC insures deposits of up to $250,000 per depositor. What percentage of those deposits at SVB were above that? Do you imagine? Other regional banks got hammered on Wall Street for a spell. Trading was halted for First Republic Bank, Signature Bank, and PacWest Bancorp. Ultimately, First Republic down 15% today. Signature lost 23%. PacWest down 38%. Bond prices went up. The yield on the 10-year T-note down 3.68%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All told, since Russia went to war in Ukraine a little bit more than a year ago, the Western allies have frozen or seized more than $58 billion worth of Russian assets. The Russian Elites Proxies and Oligarchs Task Force, which is REPO for short, which is also, come on, pretty clever, REPO. Anyway, they lead that effort, and at its meeting yesterday, they said they would be cranking things up. But over in the UK, a group that campaigns for tougher enforcement on tax evasion says a recent ruling by the European Court of Justice essentially lets oligarchs off the hook. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more on that.
The case involved Patrick Hansen, a wealthy businessman based in Luxembourg. He objected to appearing in a public register detailing his ownership of certain companies. Such registers, and there's now one in most EU member states, are designed to combat money laundering. But Hansen complained that it violated his right to privacy. The European Court of Justice agreed. Another Luxembourg resident did not, Roman Borisovic, an anti-money laundering campaigner.
Ownership of assets, ownership of wealth is a public matter. The transparency of assets doesn't have anything to do with privacy.
Especially in this case, he says, since Patrick Hansen had violated his own privacy, flaunting his wealth and bragging about his travel arrangements on social media.
This case should have been thrown out before even considered, on that basis alone.
Hansen did not respond to our request for an interview, but curiosity about his financial affairs does seem justified. It's been revealed that his company has received more than $100 million in loans from wealthy Russians. Mark Bu Mansour of the campaign group Tax Justice Network says the ruling by the European Court of Justice is a setback in the hunt for oligarchs' assets.
Russian oligarchs can more easily evade EU sanctions today than they were able to at the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine a year ago.
Since the court's decision, more than half a dozen EU countries have closed to public scrutiny their registers of real or beneficial ownership. More are likely to follow. Bu Mansour fears that the scope for sanctions dodging, tax evasion and money laundering in Europe has just been widened.
Beneficial ownership registers, public access to these beneficial ownerships, that's one of our tools to start lifting the lid on this pile of wealth held offshore and counteracting the secretive arrangements.
A number of other campaign groups have denounced the court's decision. Transparency International said it had set back the fight against cross-border corruption by years. The Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project said it had opened the floodgates to dirty money. But some keen supporters of financial transparency are less alarmed. Tom Keating is head of the Centre for Financial Crime and Security Studies in London.
Not having open access to this data is an issue.
It is a setback, he says, but
it is not the end of the world.
He points out that law enforcement still has full access to real ownership details. What worried the court, he said, was the wide open access for everyone. The European Parliament and Council are now working on a new directive that will tighten definitions, taking the judgment into account.
That sets us a challenge. How do we ensure that that access is appropriate and proportionate? And I think that's where the challenge now lies, making this access proportionate.
But any restriction at all on public access to a beneficial ownership register is anathema to anti-money laundering campaigner Roman Borisovich.
It's because of the public scrutiny, it's because of the media, it's because of the activists. Civil society is what has been driving this campaign for transparency and for anti-money laundering.
Underfunded Western law enforcement agencies, he says, need the public's help, especially it would seem since official enthusiasm for the hunt for kleptocrats' assets may be waning. In a gloomy assessment 1 year after the invasion of Ukraine, Transparency International says that governments need to get more serious about targeting the illicit wealth stashed within their borders. At the European Desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Over the past couple of years, the glass half full view of the commercial real estate market, office space specifically, has been centered around one catchphrase, more often, honestly, associated with financials: flight to quality. Sure, the demand for dingy cubicles under fluorescent lighting was crumbling, the theory went, but the trophy buildings, the high-profile skyscrapers with great views and lush amenities, big companies still wanted to be able to say they had a floor in the best buildings in town. Those trophy buildings might have survived COVID, but as Marketplace's Matt Levin reports, they're having a tough time with this economy right now.
Commercial real estate people divide office buildings into three categories of descending quality: Class A, B, and C. And at the tip top of Class A are the trophy buildings. Beautiful lobbies, gleaming bathrooms, rooftop terraces with Wi-Fi.
You hear things about like the golf simulators getting thrown in there so you can go in and play, you know, a round of virtual golf.
David Smith works for the commercial real estate firm Cushman & Wakefield. He says when big tech was hiring like crazy in 2021, they wanted those amenities to eventually lure employees back to the office.
The tech sector in particular accounted for about a fifth of all leasing activity at that point.
But now big tech and other big companies are in cost-cutting mode. Salesforce recently dumped six floors of Salesforce Tower onto the sublease market. And nationally, the occupied square footage for premier downtown offices fell by 3.8 million at the end of 2022. That's according to Thomas LaSalvi at Moody's Analytics.
This is a time of economic softening. One slightly easy way to release some cost is to try to get rid of some of your real estate.
LaSalvia says he doesn't foresee a crash, but he predicts trophy building landlords will offer more concessions to tenants. Free round of virtual golf, anyone? I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
The focus this week has been jobs, as you know, if you've been listening real closely. We had JOLTS the other day, the February unemployment report this morning. As we turn to next week, though, and as I mentioned with Catherine and Gina, it's going to be retail sales in the spotlight. So to the phones we went and got Annie Lang Hartman on the line. She's the owner of Wild Letty, which is an outdoor goods and paper business up in Leland, Michigan.
One thing that's going on right now that we did not plan on or expect to happen is another location in Suttons Bay, Michigan opened up. that is much bigger than our current location. And we jumped at signing that lease because the plan has always been, as far as the retail side of our business, was to have stores that are true women's outdoor lifestyle store. So with that store, we are not only going to be having our entire line of Wild Bloody products, but we can also bring in clothing and accessories that our ideal customer is looking for. So we're very excited to be able to expand our footprint that way. So over the next 3 to 4 months, a lot of our focus is going to be on that. We have fixtures to build and painting to do and signs to put up and all of that fun stuff. We have so much buying to do to fill these stores. We have products coming in every day. Just a lot of moving parts and pieces. So budgeting is not necessarily a challenge, but a hurdle day to day, just to make sure that we're spending money on the right things at the right time. We are keeping our current smaller location in Sutton's Bay as well. We're going to turn that into a sister store. There's so many artists and makers and brands that I love, and we're going to have artwork and jewelry and that kind of thing that I personally love that doesn't necessarily fit in the outdoor lifestyle store that Wild Bloody is going to become, but it's going to complement it.
Annie Lang Hartman is the owner. Wild Bloody is the store. Leland, Michigan is the place. This final note on the way out today, offered because if we stop talking about this stuff, we are going to stop talking about it. The unemployment rate in this economy last month, as you know, 3.6% overall. For Black Americans, 5.7%. That is up from 5.4%. Much as with the overall population, though, that's because more people came back into the labor force. All right, we are going on a Friday. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. It's a calendar update, really. March 21st and 22nd. What's that, you ask? Why those dates, Kai? Next Fed meeting, that's why. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. It's a good thing I amused myself in this job, huh? Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.